From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Wandering in the English countryside, a poet stops to rest, falls asleep, and dreams. His vision fills itself with fantastic images of right and wrong, reason and conscience, truth and fraud, life, virtue, and death. Such literary dream visions are as old as literature itself. But in medieval English literature, one finds a supreme example of moral allegory that investigates individual and social behavior. The poem is Piers Plowman, which dates to the latter portion of the 14th century in England. Soundings invited two modern editors of Piers Plowman to discuss the poem and to describe its importance for contemporary audiences. George Russell is a professor of English at the University of Melbourne. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming edition of the C version of Piers Plowman. Joining Professor Russell in the following Soundings discussion is George Kane, William Rand Keenan Jr. Professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor Kane serves as general editor of the Athlone Press edition of Piers Plowman. In addition to his duties as general editor, George Kane is also preparing the scholarly apparatus that will accompany publication of the Athlone edition of Piers Plowman. George Kane, let me ask you to give us a sample of Piers Plowman.
Well, this is how it starts. In a summer season, when soft was the sun, he shaped me into a shrewd as he a shape were. In habit as an eremit, unholy of workers went weed in this world, wondrous to hear. Ack on a May morning on Malvern Hillis, maybe fell a folly of fiery me thochter. He was weary, for wandered, and went me to rest under a broad bonk be a boon the seed, and as he lay and leaned and looked on the watches, he slumbered into a sleeping. It sweeted so merry. Then gone my mate in a mervile of swaven that he was in a wilderness, wist he never where, ack as he beheld into the east, and heicht o' the sun he say a tour on a toft, thearly she marked. A deep dollar beneath her, a dungeon therein, with deep ditches and dark and dreadful of sichter.
What have we just heard? Tell me what you've just told us about.
Well, he tells you how one summer day, and the weather was mild, not too hot, he put on sheep's clothing. There's your first allegory, you say.
Uh-huh.
In other words, he adopted a guise which was not actually accurately reflecting his own way of life. And he went out into the world to look for excitement, wonders. And in fact, he says that did happen to me, because one May morning in the Malvern Hills, he lies down beside a stream, and the sound of the stream is so pleasant that he goes to sleep, and then he has a marvelous dream, he says. And that's how that starts.
And this is the beginning of the
poem
itself.
That's the beginning of the poem.
What is Piers Plowman? Who wrote it? Why is it important in English literary history?
Well, Piers Plowman is a long poem from the latter part of the 14th century in England, written about the time of Chaucer, maybe a little earlier than most of Chaucer's work. It is a long poem written in the traditional so-called alliterative meter, measure, of England.
That means that you have sounds that are alike, for instance, F's and S's and A's and L's, that kind of
that's
thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. The poet, whose identity we'll discuss in a moment, the poet was, in fact, a master of this line, which mm-hmm. is a line with a long, long history in English, going right back into the Germanic origins mm-hmm. of the people who came across to England.
Very, very briefly, let me ask George Kane to tell me, what is Piers Plowman about?
Well, it's about a man in the second half of the 14th century coming to terms with the world the way he saw it.
Uh-huh.
In the with the intellectual resources and the spiritual resources that his time made available to him.
Does that mean that it's about religion? This is an age of belief?
It has to be, because just about every intelligent person in those times accepted Christianity as, shall we say, the ethical and the spiritual system of all systems, and tried to explain what he saw around him in terms of it.
With a religious theme, then, give me a specific example of an incident in the poem that might illustrate its larger meaning.
All right, here's one. One of the concerns the poet has is the question of salvation, because he's aware of the Augustinian notion of predestination. He's aware of the controversy about whether man can be saved by works or whether he's only saved by divine, as it were, predilection and pre-election. And like other people in his time, he did not like the notion that an arbitrary selection of people who are going to be saved had somehow to be accepted. And in the second last dream, Joel, the third last dream, the second last dream, during the time between Christ's death on the cross, which he's dreaming about, and the resurrection, he has a dream in which he sees Christ make a raid on hell.
He makes a raid on hell?
Yes, it's called the harrying, badly pronounced, the harrowing of hell. Mm-hmm. Christ makes a raid on hell. He breaks down the gates of hell. He carries away the souls of all the just who lived before the redemption. Mm-hmm. And as he's doing that, he says to Satan, who's cowed and beaten, he says that the time will come when he'll return crowned with a crown of angels and have out of hell all men's souls. Mm-hmm. Now, you see, that's the great dream of the Christian world before, let's say, Darwin, that there was going to be this special grace. Langland puts this into a dream. He can't believe it because it's a heresy. But it would be wonderful.
You say he can't believe it.
No, it was a heresy to believe that everybody was going to be saved in the Middle Ages.
Does the poem has a reputation as a poem of social protest.
It's that too.
Is that what it's protesting against?
No. The notion of social protest is a very different thing from this. Social protest is about the fact that lawyers are rapacious, that doctors are charlatans, that you can't get anywhere in the world without, they used to call it even then, sweetening. There's a verb to sweeten, which means, I only picked that one up the other day, to give a bribe. Mm-hmm. A lot of the poem is about that, but that's not new in Langland. There was a very complicated and ritualistic set of criticisms of almost every profession or walk of life already in existence when he wrote the poem.
So we have here a poem that exists at a theological level, and we also have a poem that exists at a social level.
I call it a moral level.
A moral level.
And a theological level rather than a social one, because the concept society didn't exist in the 14th century.
Well, if I could just come in there, and I agree with what George has been saying, but I think one has to be careful about not drawing a distinction between social and moral questions.
These were all of a piece.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. I was only quarreling with the term social.
Yeah, sure.
Because that's modern.
Ah, right. But I think George's account of that single episode does throw up the kind of interest that the poem has, along with the extraordinary difficulty anybody would have in giving a description of what the poem is about, except in stark and simple terms. Mm-hmm. And in stark and simple terms, I suppose one would say it's about sin and salvation, whether actual sin or original sin and salvation.
Both.
And both. And the whole structure, the whole complex structure of the poem within terms of personal experience and within terms of man's history turns upon this whole question.
There are two basic structures in Piers Plowman. I should say at least two. One of them is a convention called the Dream Vision Convention, which accounts for those, that succession of dreams I told you about. The other is the sermon. The sermon in the Middle Ages, St. George knows more about this than I do, was a very highly developed formal structure. And people had to learn this. There were manuals for writing sermons. There was a sort of kind of Ars Poetica, which had to do with the composition of sermons. And Langland very often, in his discourse, uses the form of the sermon. But there's also the poetic structure. And the two are perfectly consonant with one another, they never conflict, because the character of the dream vision poem is that it does not have a physical form.
Mm-hmm.
It exists by virtue of a voice saying, I was in such a situation, I fell asleep and I dreamt this and I woke up.
The way it works in the hands of a major creative writer like Langland or like Chaucer is to make this dream vision convention an extraordinarily flexible and liberating principle of composition, because it frees him from the obvious shackles of the here and now. It allows him to move into areas of speculation and exploration which wouldn't otherwise be available to him. And I'm sure that this is one of the attractions of the mode to both Chaucer and Langland, who in rather different ways used it as a sort of mainline technique of this.
How, in a larger sense, how was the poem received? Who read it? Who was its audience?
Well, Chaucer read it, for sure.
Uh-huh.
This is unprovable, but certain, if you know what one means by that in a literary context. It was immensely popular.
Was it read, for instance, in churches?
No.
How would it have reached the public?
The probable public for it was, I think, the clergy in the first instance, people who were interested in the reform of the church and the reform of society.
Well, is the poem primarily a declaration of the transcendence of Christ and the Christian message, or is it primarily a complaint about what has become of the Christian message?
I don't think the message itself is impugned, do you, George?
No.
It's the way people live in terms of it,
mm-hmm.
and the failure of men to receive grace.
That is the constant tension of the poem,
yes.
I think, that there is, so to speak, this template of perfection, and then there is all the imperfection, the grubbiness of the actual life as it's lived in terms of persons or in terms of the whole history of mankind.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the individual who is supposed to have written this poem. Would it, for instance, have been an act of intellectual or theological pride even to undertake this kind of thing?
No, I don't think so. I think we've got to remember that if you grant this level of education and this kind of background that George Cain has postulated for this man,
mm-hmm.
I think it's a natural expectation that you would have this sort of speculation. On the other hand, at this time, it is becoming a little more dangerous to do this.
Mm-hmm. Politically, you mean?
Politically and in terms of the ecclesiastical authorities of the time. We're at a period where lay literacy, and particularly in terms of movements like the Lollard movement, lay participation.
Now, what is the Lollard movement, George?
Well, it's the movement associated with John Wycliffe,
mm-hmm.
and his followers. But this broadly populist kind of intervention in matters which earlier in the Middle Ages were primarily, almost exclusively, the concern of the clergy,
mm-hmm.
brings a new dimension into the thing, and the ecclesiastical authorities were showing all the signs of reacting to this as sharply as one would have expected.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the author of Piers Plowman. Have you scholars nailed that identity down?
Well, I think I'll pass this over to George Cain, beyond saying just this, that one can only proceed in terms of scraps of evidence,
mm-hmm.
of an external kind, inference, and you need to be very careful about the way you draw inferences.
Well, is it important, let me ask George Cain, is it important that we know who wrote this poem, or is the poem itself the more interesting and vital of them?
Well, when you've got a poem of this quality, everything about it is important,
mm-hmm.
and one simply makes the assumption that there is interest in the personality that produced it. I have strong opinions about this, which I can't prove, and Jordan's quite right to put the scholarly cautions. I think he was a member of the higher clergy.
Now, he
I
is
do not think
who?
Of him as a Rag Langland. The poet's name was William Langland.
Langland.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
There's good enough documentary evidence for that. We know where his family came from in Shropshire. There's even a field name, which passed, that particular field passed in heredity through about five generations of Langlands. It used to be thought that he was a sort of ragged rebel and malcontent and things like that, but this is not a poem for the marketplace. This is a poem to read in studies carefully.
How did he make his living? Was he certainly not a full-time poet?
Do you want me to guess or do you want me to tell you what he says?
Both.
He says that he is supported by his friends, and that in return for that support, he prays for them, and in his spare time presumably writes poetry. But then the he whom I just quoted is the voice that tells the dream.
The persona in the poem.
The persona in the poem. Mm-hmm. And my guess is that Langland was something, let's say, a canon in a secular cathedral, something of that sort.
A canon, meaning?
Yeah. George, you're better on this one than I am.
Well, it would mean that he's one of the resident higher clergy of a cathedral or a priory or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I agree with George Cain about that. It bears all the marks of that sort of background. There's nothing in it which would suggest, as, for example, the 19th century, and I suppose a good deal of the earlier 20th century, tended to think of this man as being a kind of ragged rebel, a kind of ecclesiastical failure, who was complaining and biting and scratching at those who had succeeded where he had failed. That, of course, is part of the fiction of the thing, but I think the reality of the thing is much more sober than that. This is a very remarkable mind and sensibility which is able to carry through a fictive discourse with us, which this kind of deception is an important element.
Let me ask you to tell me some of the special problems and difficulties that you face as editors of a poem like Piers Plowman. Is it important that an editor feel confident as he passes on to literary history a document such as Piers Plowman?
You better.
Tell me about that, George.
Well, it's very important, and it's a very great responsibility. Now, necessarily, in the whole editorial process, one's not going to expect perfection. One's not going to expect everybody to agree. One's not going to expect that one's going to get everything right. Uh-huh. I think the important thing, however, is that you must make the issues clear, and that you must provide for the reader the material upon which he or she will in turn be able to make a decision. As far as the poem's concerned, unless something dramatic like the discovery of a manuscript which offers a radically different and obviously authentic text of the poem, which is quite different from any of the manuscripts that we have at the moment. Short of that, I can't myself see any discovery that's likely profoundly to modify the situation in the near future.
Let me ask you both to comment on what would interest modern audiences about Piers Plowman, granted the difficulty of access. What is there in this poem that should concern, or that would concern modern audiences?
Well, it's just about what it's like to be a human being. And as soon as you've picked up a little of the idiom in which the poet is discussing this particular subject, you become absorbed in it. I've found students very, very responsive to it.
Give me a couple of examples, George, of instances that would engage the modern mind.
Well, there's a character in the middle of the poem called Hawkin. And Hawkin is bothered by the fact that it's awfully difficult to behave well. And he describes all the ways in which he is inclined to, or certain to, or likely to do something wrong.
Well, is he lazy? Is
no,
he a
no,
thief? What's wrong with him?
He's just an ordinary person who has trouble towing the line and obeying the rules. And it is the most fascinating character. People go mad over him because he's appealing. He's pathetic. He says, I would like to be good. And look what happens to me all the time. I do this and that. And then there's a list of the ways in which and remarkably accessible ways in which he does things he shouldn't do.
For instance?
Well, Can you quote this, George? I'm trying now to think of instances.
No, I don't have it.
No, you don't have it. All right, I'll see what I can remember. Right, if he's... He runs through just about every form of activity, you see. He likes people to think that he knows more than they do about a subject. Fairly accessible, then. I find myself in that state of mind sometimes. He likes people to know if he gives alms, if he makes a donation, you see, makes sure that people know about it. He wouldn't just do it secretly for the moral excellence of it. He's a farmer and he's ploughing, and you know they had this strip system of cultivation. He says, I just plough a couple of furrows farther into the other fellow's field. If he is doing business, he'll beat the other man down. A long, long list of absolutely realistic things of this sort, which make him so accessible, you see, that you feel, well, here is every man.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. Then there are some of the...
How does this character end up in the poem? What happens to him? What kind of advice does he get?
Well, there's an allegory about him. He has a coat. He's only got one garment, and this is a coat called Christendom, mm-hmm. and it's covered with spots and dirty. And he's got to get this cleaned up somehow. And the people who run into him, who are the dreamer watching what's going on, and Patience... And a character called Conscience, who is allegorizes the ability to tell the difference between right and wrong, they tell him how to get himself cleaned up. And he goes off the scene in tears, and what he says is how hard it is to live and be a sinful man. Now, that's the 14th century idiom, you see, that you have to pick up. But once you've caught that, then Hawken is very accessible.
Yes. And if you took the early part of the poem, it is essentially a study in graft.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And how graft runs through society. Well, now, this is eminently accessible to a 20th century reader, and many of the themes and the modes and the way that these people operate are perfectly familiar to us.
Change so the names and the settings, and you've got modern times.
It's a problem of getting accustomed to the social conventions and yes. the cultural peculiarities yes. of the 14th century.
It's a poem you've got to work at.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you've got to work at it.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to a conversation about Piers Plowman, the Middle English moral allegory attributed to William Langland that dates to the latter portion of the 14th century in England. The panelists for Soundings were two of the modern editors of Piers Plowman, George Russell of the University of Melbourne and George Kane of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. George Russell recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on an edition of the C version of Piers Plowman. George Kane is the general editor of the Athlone Press edition of the works of William Langland. Soundings concludes now with a commentary about another historic aspect of British culture that predates English literature itself, the mute stone megaliths of Stonehenge, located on England's Salisbury Plain. Here is Robert Ginger, a book critic from Greensboro, North Carolina, recently returned from a visit to England and Stonehenge.
For some reason, I've always wanted to see Stonehenge, with its surrounding graves or barrows, its wealth of prehistoric remains and ancient mysteries. It's always pulled my curiosity like a lodestone. Several weeks ago, I visited the Great Stone Circle and have had an attack of impressions and questions for my trouble. We really don't know why Stonehenge and most of the other hundreds of stone circles in England, Scotland, and Ireland were built. But Stonehenge was built 2,000 years before the Druid Construction Company could have bid for the job. But there's more to the mystery than the why of this ancient arrangement of rocks. The stone pillars seem no higher than 20 feet or so. They share none of the monumental enormity of the Great Pyramids. Its architects use nothing like the staggering craft of our great cathedrals. Stonehenge's lintelled pillars are dwarfed by the elaborate construction of Salisbury's famous cathedral, only a few miles away. The cathedral's enormous spire, vaulted arches, and spectral choruses of stained glass demand awe. Its awful magnificence would have stupefied the crude architects of Stonehenge, mute quarry workers beholding Oz. The odd thing is that these plain, stacked stones evoke as much wonder as the majestic cathedral. Here's a different order of wonder, perhaps, but clearly as profound. Consider Moses' tablets, the stone faces of Easter Island, the Washington Monument, the idea of the 2001 monolith, a marble headstone. All are stone. All transmit a durable energy. They share a resonant power, one magnified in what remains of Stonehenge. Stone reared skyward seems to bridge human hopes and limits. From the beginning, stone has been the element we've used to handle nature, to raise civilization from the ground up. We build with it, keystone and cornerstone, knit a building together. We test with the touchstone, reach with the stepping stone, measure with the milestone, shape and sharpen with the grindstone and whetstone, remember with the gravestone, fear the brimstone. Stone is the mineral basis of civilization, and Stonehenge is a memorial to that. But I'd always imagined the monolith squat in the middle of England's spare Salisbury plains, miles away from human habitation and the synthetic. It's odd to find this ancient site just off the highway, even stranger to spy apartments in the distance. And beside this 4,000-year-old building, the asphalt and brick seem downright presumptuous. There are two guards here. A short, voluble one tells me two favorite anecdotes. He once heard a tourist seriously declare how convenient it was they built Stonehenge so close to the highway. The tourist further observed that the apartment dwellers must have enjoyed watching it be built. According to the guard, vandals, especially overzealous soccer fans, have painted these stones a dozen times or so in the past few years. For that reason, you can now stand only on the fringe of Stonehenge. For 6 years, they have been cordoned off from the public. Now a guard watches the stones round the clock. It's even protected by a burglar alarm. The guard I talk with seems especially wary of the thousands of campers who descend upon the site during summer solstice to seek vibrations. Even now in the distance you can see the colors of pavilions and pitched tents in a neighboring meadow, the camps of Stonehenge pilgrims. Stonehenge vandals are not new. Stonehenge has always been a magnet for desecration. Tourists used to make a ritual of chipping stone souvenirs from it. Stonehenge needs watching, but the idea of the monoliths modernized with a burglar alarm is shocking in some odd way. You can come unhinged at Stonehenge, wondering about the stone circle by daylight, not to mention full moonlight. There's something eerie about the place. In its stunted, silent reach, Stonehenge celebrates a rude, fugitive spirit. There's nothing of the pomp and hubris of the pyramid builders here. Instead, a primitive but earnest effort to build a conduit between earth and heaven. Its builders may have wanted a marketplace, a lunar temple, a stone poem to nature, but the why only adds to the power of this ancient stone enigma.
Robert Ginger is book critic for the Greensboro, North Carolina News and Record. The program is Soundings from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about a contemporary theme, American Broadcasting and Social Responsibility. The panelists will be Dr. Frank Stanton, President Emeritus of CBS, Bruce Christensen, President of the Public Broadcasting Service, and Raymond Carroll, a Professor of Communications at the University of Alabama and Editor of Feedback, the publication of the Broadcast Education Association. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.